Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you all very much for coming. I thought you would be tired and fed up and sick to the teeth of hearing about the G8 by this stage and how your taxes have gone to build yet another wall in Germany. I think it will become clear quite quickly that what we have today is not so much law after lunch as politics after lunch, but that is the inherent trait of the G8 as an institution, as a summit, and that's something we will come to later on, the very reason for its existence in the avoidance of law in general. I'd like to start maybe by just providing you with a quick outline of what I hope to talk about over the next 45 minutes or so. I think it's important to go back in history just a little bit to set everything in context and to explain how the G8 came to be, how it came into existence, and what the context was when it was established just over 30 years ago. I'll then try to explain the role of the G8, what purpose it tries to serve, or at least the general theories about the role of the G8. As it is politics and not law, there's a wide disagreement as to that. The G8 is often spoken about in the context of global governance, so I'd also like to briefly discuss the concept of global governance, what it means and how it has evolved from the time when the G8 was established until today, and how it has changed over that time, and what role the G8 plays in that today. And then lastly, I'll speak about the suggestions for reform of the G8. It's really no longer a debate as to whether the G8 needs reform, but how the G8 should be reformed. That goes on within the G8 as well as outside the G8. So let me just start by putting this in a little bit of historical context. The impetus, if you like, for the establishment of this informal group emerged from two related developments in the late 1960s or early 1970s. There was a perception that the United States was in sharp decline throughout the 1960s. And in many ways, that was actually quite true. In relation to this, there was also a perception that the traditional multilateral organs that had been established since the end of the Second World War were no longer able to deal effectively with crises on an international or global scale. And these two things were very much linked together. In the United States, you had serious balance of payments crisis throughout the 1960s, starting in about 1957 or 58. The US also had its first trade deficit for the first time in the 20th century, which was sustained over a period of years. The Vietnam War, of course, which provoked enormous sentiment at home and abroad, particularly in the 1970s. And this was directly related to inflationary tendencies within the United States because of the policies of President Johnson and how he chose to fund that war. There was also the decline of the value of the dollar, the decline of gold stocks. And as you know, under the original Bretton Woods system, the system established after the Second World War to try to provide a predictable global monetary policy. Most of the currencies in the world, at least those that were members of the World Bank and the IMF, were pegged to the United States dollar, and that dollar was convertible into gold. Now, the result of the Vietnam War, inflation, and all of these other issues here meant that the gold stocks in the United States declined sharply. The value of the dollar declined, and there was decreasing confidence in the ability of the United States to maintain this system. And then in August 1971, President Richard Nixon, without contacting any of his colleagues, either within his own administration, funnily enough, or overseas, decided to suspend the convertibility of the US dollar to gold overnight. In addition to many other quite drastic economic policy changes, which took effect immediately on the 15th of August, 1971. This meant that there was a shift from fixed to floating exchange rates. Meanwhile, you also had the rise of international currency markets. Throughout the 1960s, a lot of banks became involved in mergers and acquisitions, creating giant banks as we know them today, which became very much involved in currency speculation. And this was also an issue that that led to the collapse of the Bretton Woods system. Of course, at the same time, you had the revival of the European and Japanese economies. The Deutschmark and the yen were very much undervalued by that stage, while the dollar was overvalued. And also, there was a sense that the traditional institutions of multilateral cooperation were quite cumbersome. They were growing in size. They were becoming very, very, very bureaucratic, not only the IMF and the World Bank, but others also. And there was a sense, at least in the major Western powers, that these institutions were no longer capable of reconciling the differences between Western powers. At the same time, you had the process of decolonization, which was going on. The number of countries in the world basically doubled in the period of about 10 years. This dramatically changed the demography of the United Nations General Assembly. Developing countries for the first time now had a majority at the General Assembly and began to realize that their political independence wasn't necessarily accompanied by economic independence. And so they began to demand a new international economic order. In order to circumvent the General Assembly and the bureaucracy of the United Nations system, the Western powers decided to meet informally to discuss these general trends, these general issues that were taking place. Of course, then in 1973, you had, following the Yom Kippur War in the Middle East, the first oil crisis, which led to a global recession, particularly in the OECD countries. And so in March 1973, the finance ministers, not the leaders, not the heads of state, but the finance ministers of the US, the UK, France, and Germany, met in the White House library, a room that the current president probably has never visited. I think he prefers the underground bowling alley. But this group became known quite quickly as the library group, for the venue in which they first met to discuss these issues. Helmut Schmidt was the finance minister here, of course, at the time, and Valéry Giscard d'Estaing was the finance minister in France. And within a year of this meeting, Helmut Schmidt had become chancellor, and Giscard d'Estaing had become president of France. And so, because of their expertise, knowledge, and experience in financial and economic matters, they decided to continue these meetings and quite quickly invited Japan as an emerging power. In 1975, following their meetings in relation to the Helsinki Final Act, which established the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the President of France invited all of the finance and foreign ministers, as well as the leaders of these countries, along with Italy, to the first Summit of the Six, as it was called, in 1975 at Rambouillet, just outside Paris. To try to go through this quite quickly, this is just an outline of how the group expanded relatively quickly. 1976 at Puerto Rico, Canada was invited to join. And now it was called the Summit of the Seven, or the Seven Power Summit. And that's really what it was known as for most of its existence until the past few years. It was only later that the G was added in for marketing effects or ease of use or whatever. But it was always called the Summit of the Seven, or the Seven Power Summit. And many people would argue that what they were trying to achieve by giving it this title was to divert attention away from the other activities that were taking place throughout the year. They had each leader appointed a personal representative called a Sherpa, after the Nepalese mountain guides, who would spend their time organizing and preparing for these summits. But there were also a series of ministerial summits that took place at the same time. And to some extent, it's argued that they wanted to deflect attention away from that and to focus just purely on the one annual meeting that took place. Incidentally, 1976 was the only year with seven participants. And anybody who's followed this for a long time will know the organization really as the G7. But the terminology has been quite confusing over the years. In 1977, the EC joined permanently, although we rarely hear so much about the EC, but it has been a full member of the G7, G8, although as a member, it's not counted in the number which is attached to the letter. So it can be a bit confusing, but it has always been there, and the EU is a full member. The output, if you like, of these summits was a statement or a communique which gave a general sense of cohesion and collectiveness together between all these states. And they primarily dealt with economic matters, financial matters in the early days. But from 1977 on, it was expanded, and they had separate annexes. So they had the original communique, which dealt with the macroeconomic issues, and then added to this in 77 on North-South relations, trade, energy issues, world economic prospects, and so on. Politics became part of the agenda pretty much about 5 years after its origin, when it released its first political statement on terrorism and hijacking of aircraft, ironically enough, in the same statement in 78. That expanded quite quickly after that onto political statements about the general issues of the day. In terms of its openness to inclusion of people or leaders or countries other than themselves, in 1989, the leaders of 15 developing countries were invited to meet with the G7 leaders, not at the summit, but just before the summit. And in London in 91, the Soviet Union, Russia, was invited to join after the summit. Again, Russia's involvement was on the margins of the summit from 91 until about 97. Bill Clinton claims in his own autobiography that the reason for Russia's inclusion was basically a deal that Russia would be allowed to join in return for not objecting to the eastward expansion of NATO, and also for implementing the economic reforms that were advocated by the International Monetary Fund. It was Russia's inclusion, of course, that began a lot of debate about whether or not the G7 represented the seven largest industrial democracies in the world, because Russia, whether or not Russia was a democracy was obviously debated at that point. But Russia's participation was mostly political, and in fact, the G7 operated in parallel with the G8 right up until last year when Russia hosted the summit. And so the G7 countries met to discuss all the economic and financial matters throughout the 1990s and right up until last year. Then in Köln in 1999, a group called the G20 Finance Ministers was formed, which brought together most of the emerging market economies, the larger economies, some developing economies, and some others from the Middle East, and also the central bank governors. This group is sometimes referred to as the F20, because there is another group called the G20 at the WTO. And the Chinese official Chinese website, China, hosted the G20 summit in 2005, says that this group was formed because of a lack of legitimacy and influence of the G8 operating without the emerging market countries. And the establishment of this extra group that operates in parallel with the G8 is one of the more important aspects, I would argue, of the development of the G8 over the last 10 years or so. Africa finally managed to make its way onto the agenda very, very, very slowly, but eventually a little bit of substance was given to the rhetoric in the communiques, and African leaders were finally invited in 2000 in Japan and have been present at every summit since. 4 years ago in France, the G8 created this Africa Partnership Forum, which now meets twice a year outside the summit venue, although African leaders still do attend the summit as well. And then 2 years ago in Scotland, the G8 plus 5 was born, which basically took the five largest emerging markets from the G20 group and brought them together as a single group to discuss various economic and political issues with the G8. I should also mention that there have been two special summits. So apart from the 33 annual summits that have taken place, there were two special summits held, one in Guadeloupe in the Caribbean in 1979 on arms control negotiations, placing of missiles in Europe and the situation in Iran. And then in Moscow in 96, there was a special summit on nuclear safety and security. Also, the major ministries in the various states have been given the remit by their leaders to meet on specific issues and to follow up on specific issues over this period. So finance, foreign affairs, employment, labor, energy, environment, justice and home affairs, development, and so on. They've also had thematic meetings as well as these meetings. So issues where not every country might necessarily have a ministry. So terrorism, crime, information, and so on. So there has been a kind of a general trend that in the 1970s, economic and monetary issues were dominant. Political and security issues then very much came onto the agenda in the 1980s. And then finally, in the last 10 years or so, environmental and wider issues of development and global governance have come onto the agenda. But that might simplify things a little bit, because even if you look at the agenda from the very, very first meeting in 1975, there were statements about and issues on the agenda about the relationship with developing countries, about energy issues, multilateral trade negotiations, and even the concept of responsibilities of democracies. So it's something of a, it's not entirely accurate to say that it has always or was originally a very much an economic or a financial institution. Now the role of the G8, again, this is politics and it's not law. And so this very much depends on your position and your view of the world. Looking at the academic literature, there's basically 9 completely different approaches to what the G8 is, how to explain it, whether to understand it as a central institution, an extremely powerful institution, an institution that betters the world, that provides a forum that can help us to understand each other and so on, or whether it's a very negative force in the world. Obviously, we don't have time to go through all those, but just to give you the overview that there is no general agreement on how to even approach the concept of the G8 in international relations theory. All these competing models offer different and very poorly specified conceptions of what core functions and roles the G8 does perform or should perform. And there isn't very much consensus either on the essential analytic or empirical points that should be dealt with in trying to analyze the G8. There's even disagreement on what to analyze in the G8. In the early days, the focus was on the summit itself, obviously. But in the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a huge amount of interest in these side meetings that go on, the ministers' meetings that go on throughout the year, and the relationship between the G8 and the international financial institutions and the private sector and so on. From the perspective of the leaders, the summit itself performs 8 roles, according to John Curtin, who a Canadian scholar who's been analyzing the G8 for the last 20 years or so. He argues that there's a domestic political role. Some people often criticize the G8 for simply being a photo opportunity. And Curtin argues that, well, it is. That's exactly what it is. And that's, in fact, in many ways, a valid enough reason for many leaders to attend, that it shows to their own people at home that they're important, that they have a place on the world stage, and that it provides a lot of prestige, and that they are very much involved in helping to solve the world's problems. It also has a deliberative role. It it provides low transaction costs for as a venue for direct dialogue, for increasing communication. It allows the leaders to identify what their interests are, their compatible interests, and helps to avoid accidental or unintended conflict through misunderstanding, which has been the cause of much conflict in the past. It also helps to set agendas in countries that may not be set otherwise. I mean, every country has to prepare documents. They have to prepare statements on the issues that are going to be raised at the prospective summit. So it sort of induces governments to create, confirm, or revise their positions on particular points. It also brings wide global attention to many issues that otherwise tend to fall behind in public throughout the course of the year. It has a directional role. It can create new issues, legitimize old issues, can identify priority values, affirm new relationships. It functions as an authoritative collective decision maker, issuing statements of desired action with varying degrees of precision and obligation, and so on. It has this delivery role in which it continues. The very continuation of the summit itself is often believed to be simply a function of continuing to implement the commitments that it has made. I don't know whether that's such an important role myself, but and then it has this role of developing global governance itself. This is what a lot of people might disagree with, that the summit functions to render more permanent its capacity to implement its own commitments and to produce and develop new ones in designated areas. And it does this by issuing instructions to existing international institutions and occasionally creating its own institutions at the ministerial or official level. And so if you agree that these are general roles of the G8, rather than grand themes or ideas about what it does, then it can be sort of, in terms of analyzing its influence, divided into these three areas. So it has the geographic impact from the domestic level to the global level. It has this time-bound impact, ranging from the absolute immediate in terms of the political status of leaders and their image at home, to very long-term effects of some of the policy decisions that are made. And also the depth of impact. Many of the statements and commitments are not kept, obviously. So there's a wide range of depth of impact, from absolutely negligible and ranging right up to some cases of quite a considerable transformation of structures of global governance. To what extent the G8 has actually been successful? That depends on what they have set out themselves to achieve. In the very first summit, they stated that they came together because of shared beliefs and shared responsibilities, that they're each responsible for the government of an open democratic society dedicated to individual liberty and social advancement. Now, it's very difficult even to analyze that and to try to understand if that has been achieved, or to agree even on some of the variables to be examined to find out if that has been achieved or not. There are three schools of thought. One, of course, is that it hasn't achieved that at all, that it has failed, that it's irrelevant, or at least that it has, its role has been limited and is declining since the 1970s. The second school of thought says, yes, it has been successful, but for the negative or malevolent purposes of promoting G8 hegemony or neoliberal values, and it is actually responsible for poverty and inequality throughout the world through supporting the structures that it does. The third school of thought would say, actually, it has been successful. It has assisted the more legitimate institutions. It has prevented disaster in the face of crisis. And it has actually contributed to producing desirable global public goods. There are very limited analytical tools for trying to assess whether or not this is the case, or which of those three would be a more accurate representation of its success. But people have tried to assess, at the very least, the extent to which it has complied with its own commitments, looking at the statements, the commitments, and its own actions over the past 30 years, both collectively as a group and also individually as G8 members. The University of Toronto has a G8 research group, and they've developed this scale from minus 100% to 100% compliance with their own commitments. Minus 100% would obviously mean that they commit to something and then do the entirely the opposite thing. They break it down into essentially the period before the end of the Cold War and the period after the end of the Cold War. And you can see the results for yourself, plus 31%, plus 52%. So not a great deal of compliance, I would argue, over that general period. And of course, the levels of compliance with these commitments differ hugely between the individual members and also within individual member states, depending on which issue area they're dealing with. So for example, climate change compliance has soared since 1989. But this is only compliance in relation to the commitments it makes. Obviously, sometimes the commitments it makes are not very wide-ranging or very far-reaching. So again, it's quite difficult to exactly assess its impact in that respect. What I'm most interested in, really, is why is there so much attention focused on the G8 itself, and why is so much expected of it? I mean, in a world where you have 60,000 international organizations, you've got 3,000 intergovernmental organizations, why is there so much attention on the G8? Why, for example, does the G8 arouse so many emotions, so much more than, for example, the World Economic Forum, which takes place in Davos? I mean, and why do we need a 12 million euro wall around the G8, but not around the World Economic Forum in Davos? Well, on the surface, it appears relatively obvious. I mean, it's a symbol for many things. It symbolizes in a very concise and easy way the polarization of the world today, the divide between rich and poor, and the divided world in which we live, in which there's so much poverty and so much wealth at the same time. G8 countries only account for 14% of the world's population, but 65% of the world's global output, or GDP. The members represent 4 out of 5 of the permanent UN Security Council members, the 4 largest EU member states, the entire WTO Quad, that is the 4 major blocks at the WTO, Canada, the US, Japan, and the EU. These countries between them obviously have a significant majority of voting rights at the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, and they represent almost all overseas development assistance to Africa. And so I suppose for those reasons, it's quite valid to see the G8 as being an extremely important and influential player. But this widely held assumption that the G8 somehow represents the kind of center of global governance, the kind of informal global governance management committee, is quite fascinating, because there are many reasons to believe that it's not. But whether or not you agree with that, and whether or not there's any evidence to support that, one of the reasons why the G8 has got so much attention over the years is because it has made these claims for itself. It has perpetuated this image itself through its communiques and statements. It has often talked about how these members of this unique and elite group do have so much power and do have so much responsibility towards the rest of the world. And so they're responsible for this image themselves as well. Over the years, they've made very grand statements about their responsibility to the entire world, especially developing countries. And they have included these statements at every single one of their summits over the past 32 years. However, the specific commitments in terms of what they're going to do to help developing countries to help themselves have been very rare at the G8 summits, I should add, because they have made other commitments in other places, like the Millennium Development Goals and so on. 1977, excuse me, was an exception where they did make very specific pledges, none of which they kept. In 1990, in the United States, they said, "We reiterate that our commitment to the developing world will not be weakened by the support for reforming countries in Central and Eastern Europe. The poorest of developing nations must remain the focus of special attention." That statement was followed by a substantial decrease in support to Africa. And in fact, many of the G8 countries closed their embassies in Africa in order to shift resources to former Soviet bloc countries. The question really is whether or not global governance actually has a center at all. How relevant is the G8? What powers does it have? Is global governance managed in some kind of way? There seems to be a public perception that that these people seem to have the capacity, if not the political will, in order to manage the process of global governance better, or at least in the wider interests of the wider world. But which entities really do have that power to influence global governance, and how can they do that? I think it's important to remember that the G8 is not an organization, first and foremost. It has no founding charter, no legal personality, no secretariat, no headquarters, no staff, no formal rules, no fixed agenda. As somebody once famously said, it doesn't have a coffee shop or a pension plan, two vital signs of an organization. It does, however, have its own principles, norms, characteristics, and procedures. And these are things which are often unspoken, but around these principles and values and norms, which are shaped every time they meet, certain expectations converge, expectations in terms of behavior and actions. And this behavior and this group of principles and values is often what constitutes an institution. And the word institution, at least in English, is often misunderstood, or at least it has two meanings or more. It's often used to mean an organization, when in fact, at least in political theory, it can also mean this very kind of situation. A regime, an institution, doesn't have to have a bureaucracy. It doesn't have to have walls or vending machines or whatever. It also does have the capacity, by virtue of its human social context, it has the capacity to limit the discretion of its members to act on many issues. Certain things wouldn't become acceptable by virtue of the fact that these people meet on a regular basis. And personalities, of course, are hugely important in how the institution evolves and develops. And despite the fact that it's not an organization, it does have certain kinds of external power. But any discussions of power in global governance can often go wildly off course very quickly, because people have very, very different ideas of what that means and how it's constituted. A definition that you might often see is that power is the production in and through social relations of effects that shape the capacities of actors to determine their own circumstances and fate. And so I find that what arouses so much emotions in people about the G8 so often is the belief that the G8, both as individual states and collectively, produces these effects that shape the capacities of non-G8 states to determine their own circumstances and fate. In other words, the majority of the world is not free to determine its own circumstances and fate, because its capacities to do that are shaped by the powerful. Now, the only area where you could introduce law into this equation here would obviously be through the right to self-determination, the right to sovereignty, and going back to the UN Charter and so on. There are four different types of power. There's compulsory power, the direct control over others, backed with the threat of force. So, for example, the kind of power that says you're either with us or against us, or give us your weapons of mass destruction, even if you don't have any. There's also the example of the NATO invasion of Kosovo in 1999. Obviously, four of the five permanent members of the Security Council are also members of the G8, but they knew that China would not support an invasion of Kosovo. So the forum for this debate actually took place at the G8, and it was a G8 decision to instruct NATO to invade Kosovo. There's institutional power, the indirect control, where, for example, the design of multilateral institutions that often work to the long-term benefit or advantage of those who create it. And I think certainly people would probably agree that collectively, the G8 would show signs of having those two types of power. There's also structural power, where social capacities are constructed in direct relation to one another. So does the G8, for example, essentially maintain the global system of capitalism, liberal democracy that we have today? If it does, then it has this power to determine who in society belongs to the capital group, who belongs to the labor group, and so on. This one obviously is a much more debatable. And productive power, which essentially means the production of subjectivity in systems of meaning and signification, where, for example, a particular meaning is given to the concept of development. And when a particular meaning is given to that, it can tend to orient social activity or government policies in particular directions, and it defines what constitutes legitimate knowledge or shapes whose knowledge matters. So again, this is something that could be debated eternally, and often is. The question is, though, to what extent does the G8 act as a unit? As I said, it's not an organization. It's an institution, a regime, a club, a summit. There are major internal divisions within the G8. Obviously, the Iraq war policy, the Doha round of negotiations with the WTO are good examples of places where there are internal divisions within the G8. Also in relation to their relationship with the World Bank and the IMF. For example, in France, in I think it was 1998, the Finance Committee of the National Assembly commissioned a report, an investigation into IMF policies that were being suggested to developing countries to implement. And they found that these policies were extremely narrowly focused. They would be entirely unacceptable in France, and that they were very, very, very short-sighted, that they prescribed only one model of development when there were many models available. And so the accusation that the G8 controls the IMF, for example, I think is far too simplistic. And the France example is a good example of how there are different levels of power within the G8, different levels of influence, and different relationships between individual countries and the international financial institutions. Of course, in relation to the G8's responsibility towards the developing world in general, well, in terms of foreign policy priorities, the UK, for example, has a very different historical relationship to Africa than Japan has. And so while the UK might force the Japanese to come up with a policy on Africa, there are very, very different levels of interest in these issues within the G8 itself. The other point I want to make about the G8 is, or global governance, I should say, is to what extent can it influence non-state actors and hybrid organizations? This is something that is receiving an awful lot of attention recently in terms of global governance, that it's not only about powerful states and how they act together and intergovernmental organizations, but the increasing influence of non-state actors and hybrid organizations, which bring together state and non-state actors, both non-governmental organizations and the private sector, and so on. At this point, I think I should probably offer a little definition of what we mean by global governance. Again, there are thousands of definitions of global governance, but the one that I find is probably most accurate is this. It's very broad, but I think it's necessarily so. Global governance is the complex of formal and informal institutions, mechanisms, processes, and relationships between and among states, markets, citizens, and organizations, both inter and non-governmental, through which collective interests on the global plane are articulated, rights and obligations are established, and differences are mediated. So it's a huge field. And the first impression you get from reading this is that it goes way beyond simply states, their relationships to each other, and gives you the impression that it certainly doesn't have a center, if anything. So if this is what global governance is, then where is the role of the G8 in it? Daniel Esty, an American scholar, has offered this little matrix as a way of trying to grapple with some of these issues and try to sort of visualize this issue. It's not an entirely complete matrix, obviously. An entirely complete one would be a lot more complicated and would be three-dimensional and would include all of the various actors. This one really is about states and when they decide to act together and when they decide to delegate upwards, in other words, to supranational institutions. And Daniel Esty is looking in this matrix at questions of legitimacy. When governments behave legitimately, what issues would be controversial for them to act alone, and when it is controversial for them to delegate authority. And because states are, at least democratic states, represent some level of legitimacy, there is an assumption here that when states act together, or when they act according to their mandate as elected officials, that there is very low controversy in terms of their legitimacy. But that when they delegate functions to a higher level, to international institutions, for example, then there are very, very serious questions about legitimacy. And these are issues that are constantly debated today in the context of global governance. To what extent are supranational institutions accountable to anyone? They often take on a life of their own, and they are often independent of the states that create them in the first place. For example, the IMF and the World Bank have not consistently implemented many of the reforms that they were instructed to by the G8. And so Daniel Esty would suggest that as you move from the lower left quadrant to the upper right quadrant, you are engaging in a process whereby legitimacy becomes absolutely paramount. Down here we have intergovernmental decision making. This is relatively uncontroversial, because governments have been elected and they have the authority and responsibility to enter into negotiations. On the left, we have soft law, informal policy making, and as we move up this line of formality, we come hard formal policy making. So, for example, when governments get together in order to agree on international law, that would be this part of their treaty. When they establish supranational institutions, which then have power to affect outcomes, you have the highest level of legitimacy required, the highest level of accountability required, the highest level of equality demanded. And so this right, upper right quadrant would be the most controversial quadrant. And the reason I bring this into the equation is because to me it seems that the G8 exists in the least controversial quadrant on the whole plane, in the sense that it is not an international organization. It is a meeting of elected officials which does not intend, aim, or promise to create any kind of binding international law. And so this is why it's so interesting that the G8 is perceived to be such an influential and powerful organization, when I think it's arguable that it exists in the least controversial plane on this particular matrix. Esty goes on to talk about the which policy issues will determine the level of delegation that international organizations will be given, or that states will prefer to look after themselves. And again, these are issues that show the divisions within the G8, and also question its question its central role in global governance. So, for example, again, you have up in this quadrant here, where there's a deep, a high level of interdependence between countries and between states. When the level is extremely high of interaction between or impact on lots of different countries, and when the issues are extremely political or laden with values, then you find a very, very, very low level of delegation to international authorities, or I should say supranational authorities. On the other hand, you have, for example, issues like climate change and so on, which to some extent are becoming less political and more scientific. In this case, there is less controversy over delegating to supranational authorities. And again, I bring this up because within the G8, it is not so clear always in which quadrant the G8 would fit so neatly. Finally, I just want to make a point about reform of the G8. I mean, a lot of people would argue that not only is it not the center of global governance, but in fact, it's a relic of the past, that it was established in the early 1970s. It still remains essentially the same institution that it always has done, but the world has outpaced it in many ways, that we now have such a plethora of very complicated, complex relationships, particularly in the areas of regulation, if you like. I mean, the development of the emergence of the private sector in global governance, whereby, for example, the various aspects of the internet are not regulated by states. And there are so many other examples of situations which issues that are considered global governance that are not managed by states, or where states have delegated either upwards or downwards, and that this pattern has changed dramatically the shape of the world. And of course, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, there has been such a dramatic shift in the political landscape of the world as well, and that the G8 has not kept up to speed with this. And of course, it hasn't recognized the emerging market economies sufficiently, and so on. Some people would argue that even the members are no longer the most important states in the world. I mean, depending on how you calculate economic output, GDP, I think, I'm not an economist, but I think that GDP, gross domestic product, is no longer being really seen as a very accurate analysis of the productive output of a country. I think nowadays they're tending to use this purchasing power parity concept to try to analyze it, or try to get a more balanced view of comparing how productive countries are. And in that context, the IMF recently announced that Spain, for example, has overtaken Canada in terms of its productive output. And depending on which statistics you use, China is actually the second largest economy in the world at the moment. There have been dozens of suggestions for reform of the G8. And these can be, I think, broadly grouped into five. The first is simply not really a proposal for change or reform, but it's to continue the present arrangement without increasing membership, but to ensure the consistent participation of key states on different issues. I won't give that any time because I don't think it's very realistic. The second is to transform the G8 into an intergovernmental organization. The logic behind this argument is that multilateral activity without an organization to facilitate and enforce agreements brings up all the problems that haunt international political cooperation in the first place. Absence of trust, weak and unreliable information, incentives to defect, and reneging on agreements when it is convenient. I can see the point in that, but I also don't agree that it is an appropriate model of reform for the G8, because as we spoke about a little bit earlier, once you delegate upwards from states to international organizations, you have issues of legitimacy involved. The G8 then, I would argue, is in fact a much more legitimate organization now than it would be if it transformed itself into an intergovernmental organization. The other thing is that this kind of misses the point of why the G8 was established in the first place, which was to be able to act quickly and respond to crises. It's supposed to be unbureaucratic, not cumbersome, and be fluid and flexible, informal, and allow personal relationships to evolve and so on. So to me, it seems like an unlikely development. The third group of suggestions really concentrates around, I mentioned earlier that in 1999, the G20 was established, this group of finance ministers, which is sometimes called the F20, and that the G8 could simply expand to incorporate those countries, which would be a much more reflective of the state of the world today. I don't think that particular group would be entirely representative, because it does include Saudi Arabia, and also because South Africa is the only country in Africa that is represented at the G20. And South Africa, as many other African states will tell you, neither politically nor economically nor ideologically reflects the entire continent at all. And then the other option, which Jeffrey Sachs recently suggested, was that there should be a more of a balance between developing countries and developed countries, and that it shouldn't necessarily be associated with the size of an economy, but rather with the depth of a democracy. This, of course, would include countries, perhaps in the future, like Kenya or Nigeria, for example, or perhaps Peru over Brazil, for example, to be more reflective. But the problem with this, for me, is that it seems to be generally just trying to recreate the United Nations on a smaller level, and I'm not sure exactly what purpose it would serve. And there would also be legitimacy issues there too. I mean, why should Kenya, for example, claim to represent Tanzania? The last option, which is probably the most realistic, and this is the point I'll finish on, is that what it could do is simply move towards expanding membership to include the five or six countries that it now engages with on the margins of the summit. In the same way that Russia became a member over a period of 7-8 years, possibly if China, India, Mexico, Brazil, and South Africa continue their relationship with the G8 in the way that they are doing at the moment, then it may be probably the most realistic option to imagine that in 5-6 years from now, or as one German minister remarked recently, in the next year or two, that the G8 would expand to become a full group of 13 or 14 members, and that would be entirely full membership, both political, economic, and would be much more representative of the world as it is today. I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.